Yeah, I think we're on.
Yeah, it's on.
Okay.
Okay. I thought it might be important just to talk a little about my own personal experience when I was just a young boy growing up in our community, and then little things that happened to me that makes all the difference in the world in my life today.
Mm-hmm.
As far back as I could remember, we always live north of Keams Canyon into a valley, the first valley that goes up north and to the east side of the road there by Keams Canyon. And I don't really remember how old I was, but that's when I really start noticing things. And it was a family gathering place where my grandma and my grandpa live, and we always live right close to where they were living. Of course, they had some sheep, they had some horses, and maybe two or three cows that that they own. And I could remember going out with the older boys and tending to that. And what that did to me was really to build into my head, even when I was just a young man, the sense of responsibility, that we all have responsibility and that we all have to help in certain ways to keep the family going, to keep the tradition going within the family, and be able to practice and really live some of those responsibilities that was expected of us by the elderly. And so it was something that I always remember, and sometimes today I would dream about, you know, living back then. And the way it was that where we were living, we planted corn, we planted all of the basic food that we would need, squash, beans, potatoes, you know, those kinds of your basic staples, watermelon, pumpkins. And we had to make sure that they are good crops to be picked in the fall. And water supply, I would say, was maybe a couple miles up the canyon and into the mesa there. And we had to really almost dig up our own water. And we use an old shovel, any kind of steel that we can find. And we would dig into the earth where it was, it looks like the water was seeping out, and then you make a little pothole into the clay. And then that's where the water accumulated every day, each night. And so during the day, in the morning, you would come with a bucket and you take that water home. And then during the night, it would accumulate and some more water would come out. And the next morning, you take another 5-gallon bucket to get that water. And, of course, the sheep, they had a windmill closer to the highway, maybe about 4 or 5 miles. That's where we took the sheep. But drinking water was one of those commodities that was hard to come by. And so that was something that that we did. And I always think about today, we drank all of that water just coming out of the earth. And how come we didn't really get sick? And I guess your bodies just get used to it, and because you've been all your life been drinking that water, and you build up an immune system to any kind of a virus or what have you that might have survived or that might have been in the water. And so it's just amazing just to think about those things. And back then, And I would say this is in the probably the early 1940s. And you didn't really hear all that much about Navajo Hopi land dispute back then, because we were really living in District 6, mm-hmm. which is the Hopi territory, Hopi country. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't much discussion that I remember people talking about that. But it wasn't until perhaps during the war in the mid-1940s that I heard a lot about those kinds of local discussions, local politics, and where the Hopi Nation was really trying to push out the Navajos who were occupying some of the spaces within Hopi territory. Mm-hmm. So we had to move on several occasions from Kemah's Canyon, going up further to the east and the north side of Kemah's Canyon. And every time we move, we would move maybe 8 miles up or 10 miles up where we settled. And the settlement was such where you had to dismantle your hogan. And then we had an old wagon, a John Deere wagon that my grandfather owned. And we would use that wagon to haul all of the logs, you know, that that we use for corral, for hogan. And it was hard work, but, you know, it was also good for our bodies and good for our mind and our soul, because we were actually doing things. And back in those days, we didn't really have what you call toys. Nowadays, I, you know, live with my grandchildren, and everything that they have, we buy it for them. The parents buy it for them. And so they just end up accepting the toys as they are made, coming off the factory. And there's nothing that goes into thinking about how those toys are made. But with us, when we were at that age, when we would have some time to ourselves, we would go over to the mesa where there was a lot of moisture, and we would dig into the ground and dig out the clay that the Indian people used to make pottery. We would get that, and we would create our own toys. If we wanted to have a horse, we had to draw our own horse. We had to shape the clay into a horse or a cow, or even the little things that we would need. And so I guess when at such a young age, when you do those kinds of things, a lot of your own creativity is instilled into you, and you then become a creator of your own toys, and you have to you know, do things in such a way that you make things for yourself. You make your own toys, and you have to find places and a time when you can be alone and play the things that you like to play. And so I think people at that generation, my generation, they learn how to do all of that, which I am very grateful that happened. You know, we didn't buy things from the everything that we need. We didn't buy it at the store. Mm-hmm. We had to create it, and we had to do all of those things and find them ourselves. And so, there's a lot of talk about people having to move from the former, Navajo Hopi land disputed area. And people talk about it, and it's very, very emotional for the Navajo people. But the way I look at it is that we had to move 3 times, my family, outside of District 6. And then when we did that, we didn't move far enough so that we ended up into a disputed area, mm-hmm. where the land was jointly owned by the Hopi and Navajo. And then when that got settled in 1974, then we had to move again outside of that area because where we were living became Hopi country. The mediator and the federal government made it so that they turned that land over to the Hopi Nation. So we had to move out of that area again. So the way I look at that is that, you know, it just gave us a lot of strength. It gave us, you know, some of those things that pulled the family together. And my grandfather always said, yeah, we are having a tough time. We're having to work hard. We don't have much to eat and all of that. And every day we have to work to even to build our own dwelling place, our hogan. And we had to rebuild the corrals and all of that. But, you know, this is going to make us a stronger family. Mm-hmm. And for you young boys, it's going to make you a stronger individual where you have to do things on your own. You don't depend on anybody. Mm. We're not dependent on anybody. We're having to do all of this ourselves. And so I'm teaching you a lot of being self-reliant. And sure, there's going to be challenges in life. And this is just a good lesson for you to go through. And so that was something that I experienced during my lifetime. Grandmother and grandfather were very strong people traditionally. My grandmother never went to school. She doesn't. She didn't know a word of English. And my grandfather had some schooling. And he was a carpenter. He was a vocational education educated person. And so he knew how to do a lot of these things. And he spoke perfect English. He also spoke Hopi language and spoke the Apache language. And so he was, in every sense of the word, trilingual. Mm-hmm. And so he was a very resourceful person. And he was the person that kind of held the family together. And so that is something that I experienced during my lifetime. And one of the things that that happened during the process of us constantly having to move was people being either drafted or volunteering to go into the armed services to help during the war. And a lot of my uncles and some of my relatives served during the war, and that left us at home, mm-hmm. the young boys, only with the women. Mm-hmm. And so because of the war, my uncles and my father and other people had to leave the camp. And that put all of the responsibility on our shoulders at such a young age. And I remember at one time back in the early 1940s, we were so hungry. We were so hungry. We didn't have much to eat. And what we ate was what we found out there. And we were so hungry that we started talking about killing our own horse, the little pony that we had in the family. That was really cherished by many of the youngsters within our family. And that was really a terrible emotional experience that I went through because we were taking care of that little pony, and we had to slaughter the pony in order for us to survive. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we got together, we talked about how do you kill an animal. Well, with a sheep, it's very easy. You just get a knife and you cut their throat. And but what do you do with a horse? And so after some discussion, the lady in our family decided that my mother should be the person responsible for killing the pony. So what we did is she told us to put a cloth over the pony's eye and hang the cloth on the ears, on the two ears, so that the pony can't see. And then she got an axe and hit the pony in the forehead, and the pony went down. And but that was our food for, you know, the next several days. Mm-hmm. So we had to do those kinds of things in order for us to survive. And so I guess in my case, you have to learn from that. And the learning was that anything that you do in terms of raising your own food, you always had to save. You always had to save some of the vegetables that you may raise during the summer that you harvest in the fall for the winter. And you had to dig into the ground, into the earth, where you refrigerated the food. And then you really took a great responsibility in taking care of that. And that was our, I guess in many ways, our refrigerator. And so during the winter, we would open that, and then and that's where our food was stored. And it was one of those situations where when you're eating something, you also have your little other small siblings, brothers and sisters that were smaller than you. And you always have to keep them in mind because, you know, they want to eat too. And you don't want to be so picky, so you eat just enough to have the food go around so that, you know, you survive another day. And that was a great lesson to all of us. And I vividly remember many of those experiences when we were put into that situation. But what really taught me there was that you had to share with whatever it is that you have. And you also have to work hard even to get your own food. To eat for the day so that you can survive. And it was a good lesson. It was a good lesson for me and for many of us to go through that experience. I just wanted to talk about this so that we would have an idea what kind of background we had. It was not a situation in low mountain area where you always had a house and you had transportation, you had to pick up trucks or highways, trading posts, electricity line to take care of your basic needs. We never had those. And when we went when we were moving from place to place, we had to go down into another valley, and there were no roads. So how do you get from the top of the mesa to go down into the lower section of that land? There were no roads, and so we had to build our own roads and build it so that even the horses can be driven down the valley. And in many cases, we had to work not for 1 week or 1 month, but we had to work years just to do our own road so a wagon could go down. And so that was the kind of environment that I was raised in. And my grandfather was the one that really promoted that. He organized the community, and we all came out and had fun together. But at the same time, we were working hard, working really, really hard with shovel, with a sledgehammer, with, you know, all of the basic manual labor type tools. Crowbar and all of that we had to use to build our own roads. And so it was something that was very, very interesting background for all of us to be raised in that kind of context within my family. I just wanted to say that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do you want to stop for a minute? Or?
Yeah, let me get some water. And sure. Then we'll talk about the challenges, and you can ask questions.
I want to make sure.
I
haven't moved it. I think it's still on. I wondered if you could just back up for a minute in terms of when you made those moves. Did you, was it within land management District 6, but were you, did Low Mountain remain the closest, community, or were you, I know there are a series of places sort of sprinkled around, that area. In other words, if today we have all these chapter houses and chapters, so I wondered if you were you closer to Jedito at one point, or were you did you remain near Low Mountain still sort of the center?
Yeah, we remain mainly between Keams Canyon and what is now Low Mountain.
Okay,
that was kind of like our. Mm-hmm. Area where we live. We never really went over to Jedito or towards that area when we were in the process of moving from place to place. And Low Mountain was not Low Mountain as we know it today.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was
saying. And it was just a place. Mm-hmm. There were maybe only one or two families that lived down there, down the valley.
Uh-huh.
And so we eventually end up settling in Low Mountain, I would say, not until 1955.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. But when you went to school, you said you were in school at Tuba City?
I went to school at Tuba City. I was one of those individuals that started out late. I believe I was 9 years old when I was taken away from my family when we were living between Keams Canyon and Low Mountain up on top of the hill.
Uh-huh.
And we were taken to Tuba City boarding school.
Is that for you? Sounds like it's for you.
Hello?
That's unusual.
They'll call back.
Yeah.
Well, this is continue.
You sure? So you started at I just sort of wanted to fill in that blank a little bit. So you went to Tuba City rather than to a more...
Yeah, I went directly to Tuba City, probably mainly because many of my cousins were going to Tuba City.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my aunt, who had three boys going to school at Tuba City, was taking her children to Tuba City boarding school for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't go with them the first year, but
right.
The next year, when they were going back, they talk about how it was in school, and there was plenty of food available. There was
yes,
they played games. They played. They had softball team. Yeah. They had basketball team and all of that. And they were just talking about their school experience in their wonderful in. Enjoyable way.
Ah, interesting.
And I was listening very, very carefully, and I decided that, what I should do is join my cousins, and it didn't really matter with me if I didn't have any nice clothes, nice shoes or anything like that. And I just tagged along and I went.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, many of the other boys that were in school, some of them had outgrown their clothes.
Yes.
They couldn't really wear their clothes anymore, so they just gave them to me. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
And so it was one of those situations where I was able to fit my body into the clothes that they were throwing away. And for me, in my head, that didn't really matter with me. It was just, it was just clothes, and I treated it as, you know, that's something that you had to have, and particularly in the winter time, sure, when it gets a little colder, you need a jacket, and you know, it was a situation where I just had to, borrow in some cases, the jacket that other boys had.
Do you think having family members, relatives, going to school at the school when you got there, did that help you in terms of sort of adjusting to that different environment?
The adjustment was very hard, uh-huh, for me personally.
Yes.
And I guess it was hard because, in the first place, you know, you love your mother and you love your relatives, your father and your grandfather. And the idea of leaving, mm-hmm, them, the idea of leaving the animals behind, mm-hmm, your horses and sheep that you own, and leaving them with your family and your grandparents, not getting any younger, you know, that kind of, mm-hmm, was very emotional for me. I also knew that it had to be done that way. Uh-huh. We just have to make that break, mm-hmm, and begin being self-sufficient, mm-hmm, as an individual. And one concept was that you had to go away from home to get an education. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that was very strong in my own head. And that's why, you know, I didn't suffer as long, as much as the other children did.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I had that concept in my head that was okay, was something that I had to deal with in my life.
Were you able to see, like, you know, your mother or other persons at all from when you first started in the fall until later on? Or did they ever come over to see you, or was that discouraged? Or
my aunt, whose children were going to school there, we saw them maybe two or three times a year.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe on one occasion my mother would come, uh-huh, with her,
uh-huh,
and just to see us. But the problem was there was no highway between Kings,
yes,
Canyon,
yes,
and
exactly,
Tuba City. It was,
right,
all dirt road.
Right.
And so it was hard. It took a day for them to,
yeah,
get to from Kings Canyon to go to Tuba City.
Yeah.
And there weren't any service station along,
right,
along the way, so
right,
they had to go through a lot just to see us at the,
mm-hmm,
boarding school,
mm-hmm,
at Tuba City.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe maybe a typical day at the school? I mean, how it started and what you did.
The boarding school was conducted almost like your military institute,
mm-hmm,
where they separated the boys between what they call, you know, the big boys' dormitory and the little boys' dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
But within that dormitory living, they had what they call a platoon system,
uh-huh,
where you were each given a number. And you all had to get in line the first thing in the morning, let's say 7 o'clock in the morning, and you had to stand on your number when the whistle blew.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, your platoon leader would march you to the cafeteria.
Uh-huh.
And but when you get up and that bell or that whistle is being blown,
uh-huh,
and when you hear the whistle, you had to get out there. But prior to that, you had to wash up, you had to brush your teeth, you,
mm-hmm,
had to comb your hair, you had to make up your bed,
right,
and you had to have a nice clean clothes on, and you had to shine your shoes. And so by the time the whistle blew, you're supposed to all be ready and ready to go, and all you do is you jump and go to your number. And then they would do little drills there by your platoon leader. And then you march over to the cafeteria to eat the food, a lot of vegetables. Uh-huh. And later on, I learned that when I went to a boarding school, for example, there in Tipper City, we had an opportunity to work out in the field, mm-hmm. a place called Pasture Canyon. And that's where the school planted corn, this squash, watermelon. Much of what we were eating at the cafeteria was raised by the school, and we as a student volunteered to help the school personnel to do that. And all of that was brought into the boarding school. Mm-hmm. And then the kitchen workers prepared the food that we brought in. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of cornbread. we had a lot of beans. We had watermelon. We had corn and all of that. And that you know, it was a lot of healthy food. Mm-hmm. And so we had that for breakfast, for example. And then we came back to the dormitory, let's say around 8:30. Uh-huh. And then something like 8:45, then the whistle would blow again. Then you're supposed to all go get back on your number. And then they would march you close to where the classes were. Mm-hmm. And then they dismiss you, and then you all went to your class. And for me, for example, let's say a typical day was where I went into my English class to learn more about English, perhaps how to communicate and what the words mean, and then the spelling of those words that we were being taught. And then the next hour might be where it was devoted to learning more in working with your hands. Mm-hmm. Learning something about tools, learning something that you can create with your own hands, little toys that you might do, that you might cut out of the wood, and you sand it down, then you painted that. And you either do that for yourself or you do it for somebody or for the school. Mm-hmm. And so it was a vocational light. Class may be devoted to that kind of learning for about hour and a half. And then the next one might be physical education, where we, during the year, you had baseball, football, track, and those kinds of activities, just to exercise your body. But they really didn't have any showers. You did that just in your plain clothes, the clothes that you were wearing. You didn't go to a gymnasium. There was no gymnasium. Yeah. And so we did that. And then at noon, we went back to the cafeteria. And the cafeteria was set up in such a way that you were each given a duty. Mm-hmm. Some of the students had to cook. And so they were given a permission to leave at 11:30 or 11:15, for example. And they did work at the kitchen until all the students start showing up at 12. Mm-hmm. Then they served us food, and then afterwards they would stay until about 1:30. But we all had to go through that cycle, the cycle of working in different areas. And so the food, again, it wasn't all that good, but they were edible. There were a lot of vegetables. And for me personally, that's all I cared about was that, you know, there were nice, healthy food that came off the field.
And you weren't hungry.
That the students worked on, that I helped bring into the cafeteria. And then in the afternoon, we would go back to class, and maybe I'd be taking a math course, you know, learning how to add, learning how to subtract, learning how to divide, learning how to work with numbers and all of that, maybe do a little arithmetic work that was put together by the teacher. And then maybe another class we would learn more about hygiene, something about the study of our own bodies and the kind of food that we should be eating and what food does and what it does to our body, and then learning something about different sections of our body and all of that. And so there was a lot of health-related discussions.
And was almost all of that instruction in English?
All of that instruction was in English. Mm-hmm. And for those students that needed some interpretation, you had to go to a specialized bilingual person to help you with the teaching. But no one really, none of the students really pride themselves in going to that person because they don't want the other students to to know that they weren't really getting what they were being taught. It was kind of an embarrassment.
Sure.
So not many students took it, went to that individual. And you just had to blend in with the rest of the other students where we were being taught English.
Did they, you know, you read about and hear people say that at one point they discouraged, one way or another, they tried to discourage students from speaking Navajo as, or whatever the case might be, you know, in the dorms. They kept wanting you to speak English. Was that sort of the way it was there or not?
At Tuba City Boarding School, it was a situation where the staff and the teachers discouraged that.
Right.
And we were too small. I was too young to feel the brunt of that policy where they would get a little stricter because I think we were just too young to really try to have the staff enforce the concept of not speaking Navajo, because in my situation, I didn't really know that many English
words. That's what I wondered,
And
when you first arrived.
So the challenge was just to learn more English words. And I didn't really feel that at Tuba City. Where I did feel all of that and where I did experience some of that was at Phoenix Indian School. Because by that time we were all in school, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, and we were considered young adults, and that the instructors would say, you guys know what the rules are, you don't talk Navajo. And if you are heard talking Navajo, then you were punished for that. And that didn't happen at Tuba City Boarding School because we were too young. But it did happen at Phoenix Indian School.
Were there, I'm assuming there were some Hopi students who also may have attended the Tuba City School?
There were some what students?
Hopi?
They were from Kemah's Canyon. After going there for 2 or 3 years, I then stayed in Flagstaff public school for 1 year, and then I went to Phoenix Indian School. And at Phoenix Indian School, you had all tribes in Arizona. All 21 tribes in Arizona was at Phoenix Indian School. Of course, the majority of them were Navajo.
Right.
Many Hopi students. Apache, the Pimas, they were all there, and some other Oklahoma Indian tribal members were also enrolled at Phoenix Indian School.
Sure.
And Phoenix Indian School was a different story.
Right. And But I was just thinking, given the proximity of the Hopi community, you know, to Tuba, that maybe there were some Hopi kids that also might have gone to that school when you were there.
At Keams Canyon, I mean, at the Tuba City Boarding School, yeah, there were Hopi students there.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Not many, but there were some.
Uh-huh.
And then there were some Paiute students.
San Juan Paiute, yeah.
At Tuba City.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember any of the other tribes.
Now, at Keams, there were obviously a lot of Hopi students who went there, but there were also more Navajo students who went there than people often realize, I think.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And my grandfather was there for 2 years in the 30s, but it was before your... he was there in about 36 and 37, so... you talked about at Tuba there was an emphasis on vocational training, and you continued that at Phoenix Indian School in terms of carpentry. In the 30s and 40s during the Collier administration, Dr. Willie Morgan worked with Robert Young on some of those Little Herder in Spring, those bilingual books and things like that. Did they move away from that after after the Collier people were gone? Did they place some emphasis on trying to develop written Navajo and like at Fort Wingate they had some emphasis on weaving and silversmithing, and people like Ambrose Roanhorse and others were there. Did they have any time or any emphasis on Navajo art or anything like that at all at Tuba, or was that just
over at the Phoenix Indian School?
Uh-huh.
They really didn't have that.
Right.
In other words, we didn't have silversmithing at Phoenix Indian School. I think they were trying to get away from that.
Uh-huh.
The concept of Phoenix Indian School was there are different kind of work that's available, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. will be available mm-hmm. to you in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Phoenix, the city of Phoenix, is growing so much so fast that you need bricklayers to build the buildings. You need electricians. You need carpenters. You need... Mm-hmm. All of these different people with different skills.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to train you so that when you graduate, you'll just mm-hmm. naturally fit into the growing city of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And sheet metal work was very heavy, mm-hmm. heavy
mm-hmm.
because people... were running swamp coolers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and so sheet metal work was something that Phoenix Indian School really took pride in teaching the Indian kids. And many of the students that graduated as sheet metal worker went right into those jobs. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Phoenix Indian School was trying to do. Now, later on, I learned that what Phoenix Indian School was trying to do was a little different than what the school at Fort Wingate was teaching, because you didn't have the same kind of environment that Phoenix Indian School had back over at Fort Wingate, and so silversmithing and these kinds of traits was being taught at Fort Wingate, and what students could do with their own hands and with their own mind in terms of being creative.
Mm-hmm.
And at Phoenix Indian School, it was completely different.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the percentage of Navajo students would have been much higher at Wingate, too, wouldn't it? I think, than at Phoenix Indian School, but maybe not. But like your father-in-law, Kenneth Begay, he went to Wingate,
mm-hmm.
and I've had students, you know, look into some of the histories, and they're surprised that there, you know, like at Albuquerque Indian School, there was some emphasis on weaving, and at Wingate they were looking into the use of, you know, vegetable dyes and just different ways of doing things. And it's sort of, you know, sort of different than the initial image you had of the school. But the curriculum you're describing for Phoenix Indian School sounds a lot like what they were about to do at Intermountain, too. That was all those students who went up there, there was very strong emphasis on, you know, vocational training and not, you know, not, there weren't a whole lot of people telling you should think about going to college. You've told my classes about how when you decided you wanted to go to college, the people at Phoenix Indian School were not necessarily, didn't necessarily think that was a great idea.
I think when you look at all these boarding schools, like Phoenix, Fort Wingate, Albuquerque, Intermountain, mm-hmm. Sherman Institute, mm-hmm. Chilaco, Oklahoma, right. All those boarding schools, they were not really geared towards putting the students into colleges right. And university.
Right.
Because the concept was that we're not capable of doing any mm-hmm. college-related work. Mm-hmm. And that we're more suited for working with our hands and putting us mm-hmm. out into mm-hmm. the workforce, mm-hmm. Out in the community. That was their goal.
Mm-hmm.
But there were few students mm-hmm. from all of these boarding schools that went on to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that those are exceptional students.
Yes.
They were students that made it on their own. They were mm-hmm. intelligent people mm-hmm. that had a different background than most of the other kids,
mm-hmm.
and so that it's for me it's just a miracle that so many of our kids went through that program.
Yes.
That may have been capable of doing college mm-hmm. work,
mm-hmm.
and but they were really never given the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only a very few of us that saw different mm-hmm. opportunities in a different mm-hmm. direction. And then mm-hmm. we just kind of took advantage of those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. You had to be pretty determined.
You had to be pretty determined and really function on your own to find your own mm-hmm. scholarship, mm-hmm. to find your own way to a university. No one really helped you. Uh-huh. There were no college scholarship, yeah. for example, from the Navajo Nation.
Right.
They didn't have a scholarship program. And so when I came here and went to Phoenix College and mm-hmm. ASU,
mm-hmm.
there were no Navajo scholarship mm-hmm. programs.
And there weren't very many Navajo students.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's why we only had at ASU, when I got here, 7 or 8 yeah. Indian students here on campus.
Tell me a little about what it was like going to Phoenix College. That as I recall, some of those buildings had just been constructed through the WPA funds and things like that, and junior colleges were just sort of getting started in many ways at that time. But that was a bit of a bridge for you, I would think. It was kind of a transition, helped you get ready for ASU in some ways.
Yeah, I decided to go to Phoenix College because, one, it was closer to Phoenix Indian School.
Sure.
And number two, a basketball coach at Phoenix Indian School by the name of Joe Famulette, who was a famous Indian school coach
uh-huh.
that really encouraged me that I should go to Phoenix College. And that he had some conversation with the basketball coach there.
Uh-huh.
And so one day Coach Famulette called me into his office and he says, if you want to go to Phoenix College, you can get on the coach's program
uh-huh.
And play some basketball there. And for that, in exchange for you playing on the team, then you would be able to get free ticket for your meals uh-huh. and tuition uh-huh. and books you don't really have to pay for anything. And so I looked at that and enrolled at Phoenix College.
Where did you live?
I live, for a while, I live at Phoenix Indian School during the first semester. But then I had to move out, I believe it was in December or January, because there were more students that were coming in at Phoenix Indian School, and I had to leave and give my room to those incoming students. And so Coach Familette just picked me up, and he says that you can live with us. You can we just have one spare room. And you can live there, and you can walk to Phoenix College.
Oh, that's,
And so what I did at Phoenix Indian School was I walk every morning from 3rd Street on Indian School Road all the way to 16th Street on Thomas Road.
Yeah, I was going to say on Thomas, yeah.
And and that was walking every morning.
Good for you.
Yeah, and once I made the basketball team, then I got to know other players on the team. Then they gave me a ride back back to the dorm, back to the Phoenix Indian School campus at the dormitory, and so I was able to make those kinds of arrangements by getting to know some of those players.
Were there other Indian players on the team?
There was one other American Indian students on the team, and that's Rodney Lewis.
Oh, sure.
Rodney Lewis went to North High School, and he was one of the better players in the city of Phoenix back then, and did very, very well.
This is the from the well-known family at Gila River, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he is... from Gila River, a member of the tribe, and his father was a preacher there at Indian School. He had a church there, and many of the Indian School kids went to his church, and just a really good, solid family, and they really believe in education, and so Rodney Lewis had a good background because his family was so strong in community affairs, worked with many, many of the Indian people here in the city of Phoenix.
And for the basketball team, what was your strength as a player? What did you especially like about basketball or part of the game?
I played on the team. I made the team, and unfortunately, during the season, I really got beaten up. My tooth was knocked out, and the first time I lost my front tooth, and I had to. It was broken in half, and I had to go through the Phoenix Indian hospital to take care of it, and then the other thing was that my ankle, I had a broken ankle right at the lower half of my ankle in high school, and that never really healed up. It was always with me. The doctor was advising me that when you break an ankle like that and you stay in bed. And you stay in bed for so long, you get tired of staying in bed, and then sometimes you think you get well, so you start using your feet again. You start walking again.
Maybe too soon.
And yes, the first day it won't hurt, and but what you're really really doing is that you're using it before it gets completely healed. And if you keep on using it and keeping on using it, it never really, really heals up. And so you're just damaging your ankle. Well, when I was at Phoenix College, I sprained my ankle in the same site, in the same place. And that was really painful. It mm-hmm. was the most painful thing that I ever experienced. At nights, it would swell up.
Yeah.
And the doctor says that you're just going through a lot of painful process towards healing your ankle. Mm-hmm. And that the only thing that they could do was just give me some strong medicine sure. to take care of the pain.
Yeah.
And they don't actually really treat it. And, yes, I did have a brace mm-hmm. that they put on. But then you get tired of that too, and so
yeah.
you end up taking it off because sure. because you can't wear shoes,
right?
And so you get tired of that too, and so that's what happened to me uh-huh. at Phoenix College, and I end up dropping out towards the uh-huh. middle uh-huh. or 2/3 of the season.
That's too bad.
And so that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. And when you decided to come to ASU, which I guess wasn't ASU yet, did you think at all about going somewhere else to school, or just it was the nearby?
I didn't really think about going anywhere else. Uh-huh. I enrolled at Phoenix College in 1958,
uh-huh.
and I went to school there for 2 years uh-huh. or a year and a half or 2 years. And then in 1960, I came to ASU. Uh-huh. And I really did not think about going anywhere else except to go sure. to ASU. And that was because I knew people here sure, in the city of Phoenix. And I had some support from mm-hmm. other people that I knew here in Phoenix mm-hmm. that I could rely on. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't rely on my parents because they weren't working.
Sure.
They were living 330 miles away from Phoenix on the Navajo Nation. And so you had to learn how to shift for yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't have a scholarship. Mm-hmm. But I went to ASU and I told them I could work.
Sure.
You guys need help, and yeah. I could work here.
Uh-huh.
And all I want to do is take some courses
uh-huh.
And trying to extend my education, what I have earned at Phoenix College. I want to add on to it and get my degree in education and go back to the Navajo Nation as mm-hmm. a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
That was my goal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I really, really focused on. That was what I wanted from ASU. ASU responded, and they put me to work.
That's just what I was going to say. Can you think about one or two people who made a difference for you, who were part of the staff or faculty or somewhere at ASU that sort of helped you a little bit in getting, you know, making that transition and moving on with your studies?
Well, I would credit Coach Famulette
mm-hmm.
from transitioning me from the Phoenix Indian School concept over to Phoenix College
mm-hmm.
because he offered his house, offered his home.
Great.
And so I was able to stay there
mm-hmm.
until I finished at Phoenix College. And then when I went to ASU mm-hmm. in 1960,
mm-hmm.
Bob Russell was here.
Uh-huh.
Bob Russell was just a young man getting his degree
right.
Here at ASU, working on his doctoral degree here at ASU. And at the same time, he was also an associate professor.
Right.
And,
in education.
In education. And he was one individual that also helped me.
Uh-huh.
Kind of showed me the campus and some of the people that I need to know that uh-huh. could be of some help.
Uh-huh.
So he was very, very helpful, and uh-huh. I owe a lot to the late Dr. Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person that people never really ever heard about,
uh-huh.
but in my own mind he was also very, very helpful, was a guy named Keegan. I don't remember his first name, but uh-huh. he was a professor here.
Uh-huh.
In industrial arts,
huh.
he kind of took an individual interest in me because I was different in his class. I was completely different than the other student, and he saw my work, what I was capable of doing, and the work that I was performing in his class was also a little different than the rest of the other students.
What kind of work was that?
He was an industrial arts teacher where, for example, one of the courses that he was teaching was what they call finishing.
Yes.
Where you work with metal, right, and you finish, mm-hmm, do finish work, mm-hmm, fine work, mm-hmm, when you weld things together, mm-hmm, and make sure that it holds and it's strong, and then you sand it off with a sander, and then you finish all of that and make sure whatever it is that you put on is also something that stays on. Mm-hmm. And he taught the same thing with wood, mm-hmm, the different, mm-hmm, kinds of wood, uh-huh, and how you finish and what materials, uh-huh, you use to finish wood. And some of it had to go into cabinet making and designing different things, and how the factory design different things that we use in our homes. Mm-hmm. And so he taught that. He also taught finishing work on cars, mm-hmm, vehicle, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, how you can redo the body of a car, uh-huh, and then how you can paint it and what you have to use, mm-hmm, and so a lot of handwork, and I guess Professor Keegan saw that. I like doing that kind of work, and so he kind of gave me some extra work that I could do to improve my grades, mm-hmm, for example. Mm-hmm. And so he's still around. He comes, uh-huh, around every once in a while.
Really?
He's just a great, great person.
Oh, that's terrific. And so we're about at that time, I guess. We can pick up from here. Okay.
Why don't we do this? Maybe what we'll do is you and I get together on a time again.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then let's just talk about the future.
Okay.
The challenges.
I think that's important.
On the Navajo, for example, education.
Right.
And where it's at right now, where I think it should go.
I think that would be terrific.
And then economic development,
right,
where it's at now and where it should go.
That sounds very
the population,
good,
urbanizing Navajo, mm-hmm, communities, mm-hmm, and where it's at now, mm-hmm, and the struggle that it went, mm-hmm, through, the Navajo Nation, where it's, mm-hmm, headed. I think those will be very, very good.
Good. Good.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll get Keegan's, Dr. Keegan's first name.
Uh-huh.
And the correct spelling of his name.
Okay. I really enjoyed
good
this today. I hope you did. I thought it was, there were some things I learned that I didn't know about. It reminds you how much difference an individual can make in your life, you know, that just...
We all have our heroes,
that's right?
Every
that's
one
exactly
of us.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
And mine were those three individuals.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I first arrived at NCC and I met Bob, and you know, he had that big voice, you know. And all that enthusiasm and all the rest and all that energy.
He sure had that.
Well,
yeah.
I'll say, and I just, you know, of course I met Ruth and met other people from the family, and I was so lucky to have that experience, but I can just see Bob kind of taking you in hand and saying, okay, you know, let's you can do it. In other words,
yeah,
good for him.
Okay, Peter.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So you'll go look at your calendar and figure out when.
Yeah.
When
next week. It can't be next. It can't be this month because next week I'll be.
That's fine.
I'll be in Flagstaff
sure.
on Wednesday.
Uh huh.
And then I'm going to Wallapai Reservation.
Okay.
So then the following.
Yeah, we're getting into the
Christmas. So sure. It'll be the 1st of January.
Okay. Well, sometime in January would be great.
Yeah. Okay.
And what I'll try to do is to listen to the tapes, you know, between now and then and kind of get a sense of where we've been and all the rest of it. But
okay.
I really enjoyed today, so thank
you.
Okay,
Peter.
Okay.
We'll see you, my friend.
All right. Talk more personally, you know.
Yeah.
And that was really good, you know, about his own experiences and going to school and stuff like that.
That's excellent. Well, sometimes it takes a while, probably.